ticklish business any way you look at it. Come on, we'll stick together.
Ticklish Business, the podcast devoted to honoring and deconstructing the world of classic cinema. As always, I'm your host, Kristen Lopez. TCM On Location's tour guide Sarah Louise Lilly is back, joining me as we look at the 1953 CinemaScope romantic comedy, How to Marry a Millionaire.
Yes, just watch the fur fly, as the most talked about girls in Hollywood go out loaded for big game. Monroe, Grable, and Bacall, adding their own wonderful dimensions to the eye-filling dimensions of CinemaScope, letting you in on the grand and glorious adventures of three fascinating females who pool their beauty in the greatest plot against mankind since Helen of Troy, Marie Antoinette, and Venus de Milo.
New York, New York, your busy, busy, razzle-dazzle, scandalous place, New York.
How to Marry a Millionaire initially started as a play, written by Missouri-born playwright Zoe Akins. Akins had previous success with the Ethel Barrymore drama D-Class A, and in 1930, with Hollywood transitioning from silent films to talkies, Akins penned the story of three models trying to nab wealthy husbands. The show was called The Greeks Had a Word for It, and ran for 253 performances on Broadway. With stage being a bit of a fickle mistress, Akins found it was often easier to sell the rights to her work to movie studios. So in 1932, Hollywood adapted The Greeks Had a Word for It as The Greeks Have a Word for Them. The It was apparently too licentious for the times, starring Joan Blondell, Madge Evans, and Ina Clare. Akins eventually went on to win the Pulitzer Prize for The Old Maid and co-wrote the screenplay for Greta Garbo's Camille before dying in 1958, just 5 years after the best-known interpretation of her work came to theaters. The 50s marked a similar sea change for Hollywood, with the encroachment of television drawing audiences out of the theater and onto their living room sofas. Studios attempted all manner of gimmicks to entice consumers, from the arrival of Technicolor to 3D. 20th Century Fox's solution was anamorphic widescreen, known as CinemaScope, a technique meant to lure audiences with the concept of a widescreen experience that they could never get on their puny sets at home. Daryl Zanuck saw this as a great idea for two of his projects, the biblical epic The Robe and this iteration of The Greeks Have a Word for Them. If you're wondering why this project specifically was perceived as representative of the CinemaScope process, maybe this letter from Zanuck to the production team helps. Quote, "I see an enormous improvement in the rushes on How to Marry a Millionaire. I'm not speaking of the acting, but the handling of CinemaScope. You have perfectly sharp and clear photography with amazing lighting effects with genuine three-dimensional effect." That's right, everyone. We were meant to be wowed by the photography, not anything else. Zanuck's point is understandable if you're discussing a certain type of talent on display, but I doubt audiences were really looking at that.
You know what they say about girls who wear glasses.
What are you talking about?
Men aren't attentive to girls who wear glasses.
Did you ever try it? You brought them with you, didn't you? And why don't you put them on? Find out for yourself. Now, look, if you're worried about me, I'll tell you right now, before you put them on, I already think you're quite a strudel.
Honestly?
Absolutely. I've thought so from the first minute I saw you.
Well, if you really think so...
You're crazy.
No.
You look better with them on.
As opposed to working alongside the director, screenwriter Nunnally Johnson collaborated closely with the stars to adapt Akins' original play. Johnson also borrowed plot elements from a 1946 play entitled Loco for the character played by Betty Grable. He wanted the feature to be a showcase for Lauren Bacall, though, who had gained fame for playing sultry leading ladies alongside her husband Humphrey Bogart, but who hadn't made a film in 3 years and was looking to transition. She was joined by two iconic actresses at vastly different points in their career. To play the character of Loco, the studio employed Betty Grable. Grable, once the actress synonymous with World War II, was hitting 30, and in the great world of Hollywood, that meant over the hill. How to Marry a Millionaire would be her final major success. Ironically, the woman she co-starred with ended up taking up the Grable mantle. Actress Marilyn Monroe plays the nearsighted Pola, and it just cemented her star status as one half of the comedic duo in Gentlemen Prefer Blondes, released a few months prior. Because the film starred three successful women, it was no surprise the tabloids wanted dirt on what they deemed to be an acrimonious production. If you listen to that opening trailer, they really wanted these women to hate each other. But to their dismay, the filming was relatively breezy. All three actresses got along, particularly Grable and Bacall. In fact, it's fabled, though unclear if it's actually true or not, that Grable, upon meeting Marilyn, told her, quote, "Honey, I've had it. Go get yours. It's your turn now." The only real difficulties came from Monroe's acting coach, Natasha Lyttes, who was a constant presence on the set and led to some issues, but overall, not a lot of catfighting.
"It's all mine from the crest of that second ridge to the north there, all the way around as far as the eye can see to the west, and back around that way to just beyond Old Baldy."
"All yours?"
"Yep."
"You mean all those trees and mountains and everything?"
"That's it."
"Well, for crying out loud.
Isn't it beautiful?"
"Isn't that what they call timber?"
"Best in the world."
"Well, what do you know about that?"
"I think it's the most beautiful sight in the whole world."
"Well, I certainly don't blame you."
"Pure and it's clean and plenty of room. You think you could ever come to like it?"
"Well, I never thought about it before, but I imagine I could."
Zanuck was excited to have audiences experience CinemaScope, and though this finished filming first, The Robe came to theaters quicker, because it was assumed that The Robe, with its beautiful exteriors, epic scope, biblical story, would dazzle audiences immediately with its grandiosity, while How to Marry a Millionaire would prove that CinemaScope could work just as effectively with a small ensemble story. The effect of the camera here is interesting, as it highlights many of the problems audiences now have with the medium overall, namely that the camera didn't allow for anything closer than a mid-shot, and that the trio of actresses here have to stand within a certain distance of each other in order to fit into the frame properly. The film was released in November of 1953 with a press tour that included Bacall putting her hands and footprints into the famed Grauman's Chinese forecourt. It was a hit financially and secured Academy Award nominations for its color costume design. The film's success legitimized the CinemaScope process and made a comedic star of Bacall, who'd eventually be able to work in both serious and dramatic films. It made Marilyn Monroe an even bigger icon, and Betty Grable, who ended up leaving the Fox studio after this film, went out with a bang. Interestingly, the movie, with its gimmick meant to draw audiences away from the television, ended up inspiring a show of its own. In 1957, the NTA Film Network, yes, you don't have to have heard of it, debuted a series based on the movie starring Laurie Nelson, Mary Anders, and Barbara Eden pre-I Dream of Jeannie. The series ran for 52 episodes before being canceled in 1959. When we come back, Sarah Louise Lilly and I visit New York, New York to learn more about How to Marry a Millionaire.
Hi, I'm Robert Osborne. Thanks so much for being here. It's a great time, in fact, to have joined us. It's a film from 20th Century Fox in 1953 titled How to Marry a Millionaire. Filmed in widescreen CinemaScope, its story revolves around three knockout ladies, Grable, Monroe, and Bacall, looking for rich husbands, but having no luck until they pool their financial resources and devise a plan to bring themselves to the attention of rich, eligible bachelors. So here, also with William Powell, looking suave in one of his final film appearances, also Rory Calhoun, Cameron Mitchell, and David Wayne. So from 1953, How to Marry a Millionaire.
It is the end of August, and we don't really have a centennial to celebrate right now. So I figured, why don't we look at something light and fluffy and fun? And we decided that now was a great time to maybe go back to looking at Marilyn Monroe, who actually passed away in August. So it was worth honoring her anniversary in some way. And also, it was just great to get our guest back on this week. I am joined once again by the phenomenal Sarah Louise Lilly. Sarah, how are you?
I'm great. Thank you for having me.
And Sarah, in case people have not listened to the interview that we did, which is still a Patreon perk right now, so I'm going to release it over the holidays as a early Christmas present for everybody. But in case people don't know who you are, why don't you tell us a little bit about yourself, what you do?
I host the Turner Classic Movie Classic Film Tour of New York City, along with Jason Silverman, who's my co-host. We actually just had in New York last week, last Thursday, we had the 5th anniversary tour. So we've been doing it for 5 years, which is crazy. We had a lot of backlot members there. We had a big party. It was really fun. So I host that tour twice a week in New York City, and we take guests all over New York City to all sorts of fantastic hidden, not so hidden classic film locations. And we talk about over 300 films all around New York. And I'm officially a film nerd.
I know Ben Mankiewicz was posting about the anniversary and all of that. I was so sad that I wasn't there to celebrate.
Jason and I, of course, hosted on TCM about a year ago now, talking about some of the films we talk about in the tour. And the word is on the street we'll be going back, so we'll see. Fingers crossed on that one.
When we talked about having you back on to actually do a regular episode and talk about a movie, you suggested some New York set films, and one of them was How to Marry a Millionaire. Why does this movie stand out for you as a good example of a New York film?
I don't think this movie is a groundbreaking film by any means, but I just think it's a really fun, sweet little comedy. Sutton Place, which is where the movie's set, the whole premise of the movie is this area of New York City, Sutton Place, right? They get an apartment in Sutton Place, which is affluent, richest area in New York City that got into its own in the 1950s, which is then reflected, of course, in the movies in the 50s. And the girls get this apartment together in Sutton Place to get the most eligible bachelors in New York. So the whole premise of the movie is about a setting in New York or about a New York City location. The tie-in for me was so important.
What do you think about this movie just in general? How many times have you seen this? What is your background with this movie before we talked about it today?
I've watched it a bunch of times. I rewatched it earlier in the week just because we were going to talk about it again. I just think it's really fun. I think it's not a groundbreaking film, but it's really sweet. It's fun. It's witty. Certainly, from a feminist perspective, I have to ignore things like Lauren Bacall's line about, you know, marriage is the greatest thing you'd ever achieve in this world. But I think it's an important movie for the three actresses in their careers for different reasons. The first movie to ever be shot on CinemaScope, that was huge. So I think an important film for certain things. Fun, you said it perfectly. Fun summer movie, like a little bit of a popcorn, easy, just fun little cute little film.
This is, I think, the second time I've seen this movie. If anybody has followed my blog from its inception, the first thing I ever did was I went through several of Marilyn Monroe's prominent movies. That was my first series blogging assignment. So I watched this, and I think a lot of the reasons that I don't love this film as much as I feel I should is because I saw Gentlemen Prefer Blondes first.
That's so funny you said that, because after I watched this movie, watched it on Monday night, I thought, I'm going to watch Gentlemen Prefer Blondes again. I haven't seen that movie in a long time, and I rewatched that on Tuesday night. Gentlemen Prefer Blondes is just this epic, wow, massive film, right, in comparison to this little cute little other thing. So I totally get that. It's got the wow factor, right, which, of course, this doesn't have.
Well, I think the wow factor comes from the fact that you have two of the country's biggest female icons playing in a movie together. You have Marilyn Monroe and Betty Grable. And then you have Lauren Bacall in there, who is an icon now, but at the time, she didn't have the cult of personality around her like the other two women did. I feel I should love this movie. I feel I should, because it's got three actresses that I really enjoy. It's got William Powell, who I love. And there's just something about this movie that keeps me removed. And we can talk about some of the things that I think play into that. Predominantly the fact that it's directed by Gene Nugalesco, who I don't like his movies at all. And I've seen several of them. But I think the fact that this came out right sandwiched in between Gentlemen Prefer Blondes, which came out 3 months before, and Niagara, I think, is in there. This might have been the last one.
I love Niagara, I have to say.
Niagara is phenomenal. I think people forget that there were three Marilyn movies released in 1953 alone. So Niagara came out in February. Gentlemen Prefer Blondes came out 3 months before this in the summertime. And then this came out in November. So you got a lot of Marilyn in that.
Yeah, I'm going to say that. I mean, ultra stardom. I mean, those three in a row like that. Unbelievable.
Those two movies are so fantastic. And they utilize Marilyn really well. This isn't really Marilyn's movie.
No, it's not.
The CinemaScope, I have a lot of problems with CinemaScope because CinemaScope really, really, really doesn't play well on TV. Those are the things that make me feel like it's pleasant, but I don't have the big, oh my God, I love this movie compared to other Marilyn movies that exist.
I think it's a little apples and oranges. It's almost unfair to compare this movie with the movie like Niagara or Gentlemen's Prefer Blondes, just because they are bigger movies.
Also directed by Gentlemen Prefer Blondes is Howard Hawks.
Yeah, the Howard Hawks, exactly. Henry Hathaway.
Henry Hathaway, yeah. You have poor Jean Nicolescu over here. Jean Nicolescu is a Romanian director who directed a lot of women's films. He directed The Best of Everything. Very similar to this movie in the sense that it's working women dealing with men. That movie is also very candy-coated, very glossy. He made two movies that I think are, I call them kissing cousins to this movie, which is Three Coins in a Fountain and its remake, The Pleasure Seekers. And those two movies are very similar to this. Three women go in Three Coins in a Fountain and The Pleasure Seekers into Europe, and then they get into hijinks with men. They've remade this several times. I think they made this a couple years ago with Selena Gomez called Monte Carlo, and it's essentially The Pleasure Seekers again. But he also did stuff like Johnny Belinda. He did Roadhouse, which is a fantastic, fantastic Ida Lupino movie. And he did Humoresque with my deceased lover, John Garfield. And Humoresque is a weird movie, but it's oddly compelling. But I just don't gravitate towards his films. I don't know if it's because they feel very ponderous. I don't know. I don't know what it is about him as a director. But I always see his name pop up on something. I'm like, I'm not going to care for this.
I'm not super familiar with work. I know The Best of Everything. Well, I know Daddy Long Legs. He did that. Not one of my favorite films, but he directed Daddy Long Legs with Fred Astaire. I know Three Coins in a Fountain, which, yeah, is really, really the same plot basically kind of put in Rome, which I think is beautiful and makes you just really want to go to Rome and go to Italy, you know, mostly shot on location and a bigger version of this because you've got all of these kind of great Italy countryside shots. He leaves me a little cold too. There's a little distance or something. I don't know. Yeah. But to be honest, he's not someone I know whose work I know super well. I don't think I've ever seen Humoresque. I've got to write that down and put on my watch list.
Last I checked, it might have been on Filmstruck.
I'm going to put that on my list.
Humoresque is a delightful, and I use delightful sarcastically. It's a wonderful film about Joan Crawford being so thirsty for John Garfield that she is willing to make him a star by any means necessary. And I support her in her endeavor.
What year is that?
I think it's 46.
Oh, 46, okay.
But this movie, I think a lot of the issues I have with this is CinemaScope. This was the first movie shot in CinemaScope, and Lauren Bacall famously said, quote, "As CinemaScope was a new experiment for everyone, it was difficult. One had to keep the actors moving and not too close together, as the screen was long and narrow. You shot longer scenes in CinemaScope, 5 or 6 pages without a stop, and I liked that. It felt closer to the stage." CinemaScope, you couldn't do close-ups, you couldn't do medium shots, and I think that that contributes to the distance.
That's a really good point.
Because it's literal distance, obviously.
But yeah, also, totally.
You don't get to look at these beautiful women's faces. It probably helped William Powell. He was a little old in the tooth.
And it was his second to last film, William Powell. Second to last one. It's crazy.
Lauren Bacall has a really hilarious story in her autobiography where she talks about doing something, and I want to say she hit William Powell by accident, and the strings that were holding his face up, the 1950s facelift, actually fell and his face drooped.
Oh my god, that's funny.
The CinemaScope and not doing close-ups helped him, but it does make you feel like, oh my gosh, we're looking at some beautiful, beautiful women here, some beautiful locations, some beautiful costumes, and we don't actually get to see it. And the actresses, if you look, knowing that the camera wasn't allowing the actors to be too close together, there's a real formality, I feel, in how shots are composed. You don't really get the camaraderie between the women because they couldn't be too close together because of how the camera was set up.
Interesting. I never thought about that, but, you know, you're totally right. And without this epic big musical sequences in Gentlemen's Prefer Blondes or the big shots of Rome and Three Coins in a Fountain, you don't get to really use CinemaScope in that way. So then it's...
Well, what do you think about the CinemaScope, especially knowing that other than the long shots of the city, we don't really get to see the city. It's all a lot of interiors. How do you feel the film utilizes NYC and CinemaScope?
Yeah, I mean, it's in the time period, right, where you're really getting some establishing shots in the exteriors. Like, all the action, all the actors are on a soundstage in L.A. You have numerous exterior shots of where they live, which is on the corner of Sutton Place and 55th, and we actually go past that on the tour. There's one exterior shot on location at George Washington Bridge, which I personally love just for personal reasons, when they're caught with the police going over the bridge.
5 millionth couple across the George Washington Bridge.
Exactly. So I love that on a totally personal level, only because I live in New York City just over the George Washington Bridge. So it was just like fun to me to see that on location shot when I lived just on the other side many years ago on screens. But you don't really see New York. It's mostly sets, really. I mean, you're not really seeing a lot of New York. You get a couple of exteriors, you get George Washington Bridge, and then that's pretty much it. You don't see Central Park. You don't really see New York. It's apartment on their date.
Yeah, this is not on the town.
Right.
Where they're actually showing things. Although it does start with a song that seems like it belongs in On the Town.
Oh, that's true. And in the opening credits, you do see that typical setting the stage thing, right? You see, like, it's like a montage. You see, like, Rock Center. You see Central Park in that establishing montage, very beginning of the movie. So you see a little bit then, but that's not typical. It's almost like stock footage. Let's grab some quick footage of New York City to kind of show we're in New York City.
And there's sections where they're not even supposedly in New York City. Betty Grable's character, which I know we haven't given out much plot, so I'll be sure to include that in the opening. But Betty Grable's character, Loco, I love how she doesn't even warrant a real name. They just call her that. Yet she really doesn't do anything crazy, so I want to know the backstory about that name.
That's a really good point. Marilyn has that great line about, like, it's amazing what she can do with a quarter. A little bit of a saucy reputation out of the three of them, I would say.
I would have liked some background on that. But Loco goes to a lodge with an older married man. She interprets lodge as like an Elks Lodge. And
she expects fancy parties.
It's a remote mountain cabin. They're up in the mountains a long period of time during her story. And it looks like a set. It looks like a painted background.
Yeah.
It's nice.
Then she gets the measles. They both get sick.
And that's where I'm really interested in this plot, because Gentlemen Prefer Blondes is very progressive, I think, for 1953, in that it's really a love story between women about female friendships. And here, it wants to step away a little bit from being too saucy. Loco goes up to the mountains with this guy, and he's worried his wife is gonna find out. She's worried about her reputation, but it's a really chaste, childish plot that develops. She gets the measles, and then they have to stay in bed, and they can't go out. These women are all meant to be very sexually aware, adventurous women, but they're all really chaste and lovely and almost childlike if you're looking at Marilyn or Betty. They're not Jean Tierney, I think.
Maybe not Lauren Bacall, but definitely Betty and Marilyn. Not the sharpest knives in the drawer.
Right.
There's definitely a little bit of playing up the dumb quality a little bit.
How do you know? Feel and about I think, that?
Well, it's interesting. It's talking about Gentlemen Prefer Blondes, right? There's that scene where Marilyn is talking to her future father-in-law, right? And she says, I can be smart when I want to be. And then she says, but men don't like that. And so allegedly, Marilyn wrote that line according to sort of the notes on the script. Like, she added that line. And I feel like in that movie, there's an awareness of I'm playing a role. Like, I'm playing up this dumb side of myself to get what I want because men like that. I'm gaming the system. But in this movie, How to Marry a Millionaire, they just come across, like, not that smart. So I find that problematic a little bit from a feminist perspective.
Yeah, and I think that might be what bothers me about this movie. Because Marilyn hated playing dumb. She already knew that's what people thought about her.
Yeah.
And so she really didn't like to be portrayed that way. And I think what I don't really care for about this movie is that her and Betty Grable's characters, again, two women who had been sold based on their bodies and throughout history as these beautiful women for male consumption, they're really portrayed as stupid. Betty Grable's character is constantly misinterpreting words.
When he says a ranger, right, she assumes she means a rancher and he owns, like, all the land, but it turns out he's a forest ranger and just looks after the trees, basically, and sort of, you know, oversees the property. And there's just, there's these constant things where you're like, oh, you're not that smart. And
I mean, the thing is that I thought maybe the script could have been doing something a little snarky, like men really feel the need to, like, exaggerate their qualities. Because Rory Calhoun's character, the ranger, is misleading when he's like, I own all of this over here.
I mean, that's an easy misunderstanding. Right, he does say that.
At the same time, you have Pola, who I think the thing that I love about her plotline the most is that she does bring up a good point where she's intentionally, not only Johnson changed the line, boys don't make passes at girls who wear glasses. And her whole thing is men are not attentive to girls who wear glasses. But I love that there's this awareness of her being beautiful, and that she's so afraid of losing that power that she won't even wear her glasses and proceeds to get on the wrong flight.
Yeah.
She's supposed to go to Atlantic City and she ends up on an airplane to Kansas City. And I think what Marilyn does really well in this movie is constantly reminding the audience that she's blind, she'll be walking and she'll like trip very slightly, or she'll hit something, and you're not really sure if that's her or if that's what the script calls for. And I think that's the mark of a really good actress. I just wish there was a bit more self-awareness. I just feel like they're the butt of the joke, and I wanted them more integrated and maybe more world-weary compared to Bacall.
Marilyn's physical comedy is really fantastic in this movie. As you said, I think she's really great in the movie, the tripping and the walking into walls, and I think she plays that so very truthfully. I love the scene with her and David Wayne on the plane. I think it's probably my favorite scene in the movie, of her reading the book upside down, and her lot, you said, they're not attentive to those who wear glasses, and he says she's quite a strudel, which I love that word. And I
we need to bring really that back as a compliment.
I say that on the tour sometimes. I'm like, I single-handedly want to bring back strudel into the vernacular. I think it's such a great word.
Well, we did actually get a question from Nell Manow, who has been a previous guest on the podcast. She had mentioned that she always felt that Lauren Bacall made the wrong choice in this movie, but that may be because Nell loves William Powell so much, and that explanation by David Wayne never made any sense, did it? We'll come back to the women in a second. I want to talk about the men, because I think Nell's question is really interesting. So we have several men in this movie. You have William Powell, who plays J.D. Hanley, the wealthy millionaire that captures Shotzi's heart, played by Lauren Bacall. And then you also have Rory Calhoun as the ranger. You have David Wayne as Freddy, the guy who owns the apartment but has fled the country because of income tax. And then you have Cameron Mitchell, who plays Tom Brookman, the secretly wealthy man that Shotzi keeps turning down because she thinks he's poor, but he's secretly not. They're all good. William Powell, you mentioned this was one of his last movies. The movie really doesn't seek to change his persona. He's still a nice guy.
Yeah.
He's wealthy. When Shotzi doesn't want to marry him, he's like, that's fine.
He's very easy in the movie. Like, just like he always is, he's just very easy. The scenes with her and Shotzi, he just seems so relaxed and easy. And he's just so lovely to watch.
He's still got that thin man veneer.
Totally.
He's still got it. Compared to Cameron Mitchell as Brookman, maybe because I've seen so many classic movies where the whole I'm secretly wealthy plays out. I want to say
he's kind of a stalker, right? He shows up at her place and walks. Like, he's kind of a stalker.
He calls her every day. He rents out her modeling company.
Yeah.
All three girls are models so that they can model clothes in front of him.
Yeah, I mean, he's totally a stalker.
He's very much a stalker. At the end of the movie, did you want William Powell to win, or did you feel Cameron Mitchell earned that at the end?
No, I mean, I'm with you on William Powell. But I mean, you know, ultimately the whole point of the movie, right, is like love wins and you can't control where your heart goes. Spoiler alert, she turns down William Powell and because she realizes she doesn't love him. And even though he has all this million, she walks away from that to follow her heart. And then unbeknownst to her, he is this kind of billionaire. So that's the point of the movie. Despite the three of them determined to marry for money, ultimately they don't, right? They all marry for love. But I think William Powell's a good guy in the movie. Like, when she wants to marry him at first, he says no, right? And he's like, no, I can't do that to you. I'm too old for you.
She gets that really great reference to her own husband.
Yeah, yeah. So she's like, that old guy. I love that old guy. I like older men. The old guy. What's that old guy? The African queen guy? Exactly. Shout out to Humphrey Bogart.
There's two references to their famous husbands. So there's the African Queen reference for Lauren Bacall, and then Loco is listening to the radio, and she says it's Harry James.
Yes, who's her husband. Yes.
Who was her husband at the time. I'm very sad that Marilyn wasn't married at that time.
This is 53, and she married DiMaggio in 54, I think, the next year. Although they were together for this movie, but yeah, they didn't marry until last year.
Yeah, kind of surprised there wasn't some sort of baseball reference or something.
So then William Powell does, in fact, come back, right? He has a change of heart and says, okay, I'll come back. I will marry you. I can't walk away. And so then he does go to marry her. I feel he's a little bit like not the moral compass, that's too strong, but he walks away at first, which you sort of feels like a William Powell thing to do, right?
You need that third act twist. He
yes.
goes away, and then he comes back right as she's into Tom.
And also, like, she leaves him virtually at the altar, and, like, how can you not feel for the guy then? You're just like, oh, my God, how could you do that?
That's another thing. I think the plot really kicks into high gear in the last, like, 20 minutes.
Yeah, a lot going on there. It's true.
And so, yeah, I do feel Powell deserved to win. He should have won. Yeah, David Wayne comes in the middle of the movie. He's Freddy, the guy who owns the apartment. He's trying to get into the safe so that he can get the check that will prove that he paid his taxes. And he's trying to get the money back, and by a series of shenanigans, he ends up on the same plane as Pola, who's going to marry the guy with one eye who is obviously a scoundrel and is not wealthy. I never buy that her and David Wayne ever are going to make it work.
There's that absurd line of something. Marilyn, like, comes in and says to Lauren Bacall, like, yes, after the wedding, we're going to go underground. The whole plan is to go on the run, go on the land together. The whole thing is ridiculous.
These three women have been hawking furniture and starving themselves to live this life of seeming luxury. And then she's just going to be like, nope, I'm totally okay with living off the grid. We haven't talked about Marilyn in the 50s. This was, as we mentioned, one of three movies she made in 1953 alone. How do you feel about how they're integrated as friends? I don't really think we get that they're necessarily friends. I think it all feels like a business arrangement. All three of them are living there to get a lifestyle. I feel like these are actual friends that once they get married, they're going to call each other. I always feel that once they all get married, they'll never see each other again.
That's funny. Lauren Bacall, she's always kind of the brains of the operation, right? She's a little bit more cold and she's kind of the boss. And then Betty Grable is introduced, the new one to the trio that Marilyn knows, and she's bringing her into the plan. She doesn't know Shotzi beforehand. And Marilyn's character, Betty's character, have that similar airheady slight quality. So I can see them being friends. Like, you can see those two going out in the town together. I kind of can't see any of them going out with Lauren Bacall, really. But I feel like the two of those could be friends.
There's definitely some history created between Pola and Shotzi. And there's some history between Pola and Loco. But that's about it. So I always feel like I wish there'd maybe been a couple more scenes of them interacting. Maybe if we didn't have 6 minutes of Alfred Newman playing music.
Yeah, oh my God.
I always feel like, did I put the wrong disc in? I'm not understanding what's happening here.
I love this because I think the whole press, right? And I think everyone loves pitting women against women and all the press is like, they're going to hate each other and it's going to be this whole drama. And I just love that they all supported each other.
Really?
I love that.
They really did. They said that people were really disappointed that there were not stories from behind the scenes of all three of these women, two of whom were, again, huge stars in Hollywood, arguing with each other. But Lauren Bacall said that her and Betty Grable got along really, really well. But Marilyn was standoffish because she was taking a lot of acting tips from Natasha Lyttes, who was her actor at the time. And Bacall is quoted as saying, quote, Marilyn was frightened, insecure, trusted only her coach, and was always late. During our scene, she'd look at my forehead instead of my eyes. At the end of her take, look to her coach, standing behind Jean Nugalesco for approval. If the head shake was no, she'd insist on another take. A scene often went to 15 or more takes, which meant I'd have to be good in all of them, as no one knew which one would be used. And yet, I couldn't dislike Marilyn. She had no meanness in her, no bitchery. She just had to concentrate on herself and the people who were there only for her. That might also be why this movie doesn't feel as organic and natural as something like her relationship with Gentlemen Prefer Blondes, because it had to be tough being a woman who a lot of people only said was successful because of how beautiful she was, working with Betty Grable, who also was multi-talented, and Lauren Bacall, who was a serious actress. I mean, I'm sure that had to drive Marilyn batty and make her feel like she had to be extra good.
It's funny because the quote about her saying that she looked at her forehead, not her eyes, I've noticed it a little bit also in Gentlemen Prefer Blondes a couple of times. And I thought, like, there's a certain look that Marilyn has occasionally when she's looking at her partner in the scene. And there's like a glaze over thing that happens occasionally in Gentlemen Prefer Blondes and in How to Marry a Millionaire. I think she's like not looking at her partner, her scene partner in the eye. She's like looking at the forehead. And I think in this movie, it doesn't bother me because of the whole, once she takes her glasses off, she can't see. So it kind of works in this movie, but I actually noticed that a little bit in Gentlemen Prefer Blondes, too, from an acting perspective. Like, I noticed that as a slight detachment in a moment.
This movie has some very short takes, and a lot of those scenes are them in isolation. There's really three separate movies that are included in here. When Marilyn is acting, she's mired and having to be sexy or dim-witted. It's not a real acting powerhouse for her compared to Niagara.
I think it's interesting, too. I read that they shot for 6 weeks, and Lauren Bacall said that she barely spoke to Marilyn, like, offset. They didn't really interact. She said once she came back into a dressing room, something was asking her about her family and her marriage and her children. And one day, one of Lauren Bacall's sons, I think, came on set, and Marilyn was kind of fascinated with that. And she just said that Marilyn had this kind of wistful quality and just sort of hankered for that a little bit, but just had this, kind of detachment, kind of self-absorption that just she couldn't quite connect with people and was just in her own little world with her people who were kind of looking after her. And I just, it was just a sadness around it that's just sort of, just sad, I think.
Betty Grable gets lost in the shuffle here. We've mentioned her parts in this movie. This was her last major success.
Yeah.
She had one movie after this that was very good, and then her last movie, even she admitted, was not a good movie at all. But she was queen of 20th Century Fox up until that
point. Yeah.
And I think she's very fun here. The fact that she is the one that is brought in after a certain amount of time, she is on the outside. The famous million-dollar legs covered up for a significant amount of time up until the modeling scene in the middle where she's got the legs out and about. She's out in the mountains, so she's wearing
a lot of fur, warm clothes.
But I do think she's very good at the mugging when they get stopped on the bridge and she thinks she's going to screw this guy over who's been mean to her and his wife and his daughter. She's totally going to mess with him and get him caught.
Yeah.
I like that part. Again, I think if it had been a different script, that plotline could have been a bit saucier. But I think she does really well with what she's given.
Yeah, I mean, she's sort of, probably a decade older than Marilyn, and Marilyn's going to take her spot as, like, the head blonde at Fox, right? I think it sounds like, for all reports, she just handled that with just poise and generosity, and I think she said something to Marilyn about sort of, like, it's your turn now, I had my turn, go get him or something, or really did nothing but support Marilyn, and there was no competition between the two of them, and I think that's really nice to hear. And then she went out on a high with this movie. I mean, this is a very popular movie. I think it's the second highest grossing movie after From Here to Eternity in 1953. Yeah. So, I mean, a very successful movie, pretty impressive career, and really dominated Fox for a decade. So I'm glad she got that.
Well, we haven't talked about Lauren Bacall. She is the star of this movie. This was the movie that turned her into a star. She was predominantly playing in serious dramas, often with her husband, who was Humphrey Bogart. She gets to play a comedian. I mean, she would do that very well in other movies. I think of stuff like Designing Woman and other movies that she's done, Sex and the Single Girl. And she's good here. I like that Lauren Bacall, even in comedies, was the cynic. She's the realist of the group.
She's got a coldness still. She's got a real intelligence to her, I think.
Yeah, she's not light and bubbly.
No.
She's the woman that has been burned before. She talks about how she married a poor man and then he divorced her. And now she's just bitter. But she wants to get married again. She's just going to do it smart. She's more of the darker, grittier take on Sugar Cane, if you've seen Some Like It Hot. Marilyn's character in that movie has been burned before. And so she thinks she's going to find a millionaire so that she won't end up getting that. Comedy ensues. Here, I think this is a more realistic take on that character. And Lauren Bacall is really good. I think the problem that I have is that she needs a strong leading man. That's why we want William Powell to win. She works so well opposite Bogart, opposite Gregory Peck. Her male co-stars were usually on par with her. When she's, you know, gonna throw it all away for Cameron Mitchell, I'm like, he's not even an A actor.
That's interesting. You're right. Because, I mean, he's connived. We joked about him being kind of a stalker, which he is. But you're right. He doesn't have that weight to him. You know, William Powell does. Or that kind of, like, I hate to use the word manly, but weight that you feel like in a fight, Lauren Bacall would crush it. Yeah. She would win every fight they ever had. You want her to be with someone who that evenly matched a little bit. Before this movie, I don't think Lauren Bacall hadn't done a movie in about 3 years, I think. I read in her biography, this was the first time that her and Humphrey Bogart were apart in 8 years of marriage. So he was in Italy doing another movie, and she was here in New York doing this, or LA, mostly in New York a little bit, in this movie. So yeah, she needed this movie to be a success. It relaunched her career again. It was a happy success for her as well.
That's really the thing. She worked with some huge, huge male co-stars. Obviously Bogart, Kirk Douglas, who I hate, John Wayne, Rock Hudson. I mean, even someone like Robert Stack in Written on the Wind conveys this, I don't know if it's manliness as you mentioned, but just like this
weight or something, right?
This elegance, this magnanimity that you feel like it's on par. Cameron Mitchell's character is presented as like this wealthy guy, but he's salt of the earth. Money doesn't matter to him. He wants to take her out for burgers. Gregory Peck wouldn't take you out to go get a burger, okay? He might, but it would be a classy burger.
You feel like Lauren Bacall still needs to be, like, wined and dined a little
yes.
bit somehow. You don't really buy her eating a burger in that diner and being happy
about
it.
No, I do not see her in a greasy spoon. I see. This was nominated for an Academy Award. It was nominated for Best Costume Design in Color for Charles Lemaire and Trevia. And the costumes in this are utterly beautiful. I'm a huge fan of the coat that Lauren Bacall takes off where it's pink silk on the inside. It's so beautiful. When you really look at what won that year, Best Costume Design Color, the nominees were this, The Bandwagon, Young Bess, Call Me Madam, and the winner was The Robe. which was also filmed in there. I'm sorry, but I've never seen The Robe. I know it's an epic, but you're seriously telling me that it had better costumes than everything anyone's wearing in this movie?
I mean, it's a biblical epic. I mean, not to gross generalization, but it's got to be like togas and bits of... Yeah. I mean, how good can it be? I mean, I hate to say it, but...
Come on, the dress Marilyn wears, what is it, the magenta dress that she wears to dinner, the pink gown that Betty Grable wears at the beginning with the poofy skirt. I mean, come on. How can you say that... I'm sorry, again, I've never seen The Robe, but it's in the title. It's a robe, okay? Yeah. I'm just saying, it can't be that nice.
And I think those are the moments when those costumes in CinemaScope would look amazing. On my TV, they look pretty cool, but on a big wide screen, I'd be like, wow, they would look amazing.
And please, somebody don't email me that there were more costumes in The Robe than just a robe. I know this. Okay.
I should watch The Robe. I'm going to go watch that. I put that on my list when I was thinking about this movie, because I've never seen it either, and I was like, I should really watch that.
I'm terrible with biblical epics. This is 2 hours and 15 minutes. I don't know if I have for all of that. I still get bummed that this did not win a nomination, although... If you think about it, too, Niagara's not on that list. And Niagara has fantastic costumes, as does Gentlemen Prefer Blondes. How did Marilyn just not sweep the costume category that year? I'm not understanding that.
Yeah, that's totally true. Yeah, interesting.
That kills me.
One random little tip that I want to mention was the fact that when we go past the location on the tour where the three girls live, which you see that exterior in the film numerous times, in real life, that's also where Joan Crawford lived in real life.
Oh,
okay. Fun movie and real life crossover moment.
Directed by Gene Nicolesco twice, too, so it all comes back around. But I did want to bring up the end really briefly, the last scene, all of them together with their husbands at the Greasy Spoon, and they don't believe that Cameron Mitchell's Tom is wealthy until he pulls out a wad of cash to pay, and all the women pass out, and the men have to toast to our wives. I always roll my eyes at the end because I'm just like, really? That's the image you want to put us out on? I feel this movie is very confused. Again, if you've seen Gentlemen Prefer Blondes, you're just sitting there like, I don't know how I feel about this. I don't know. Overall, I recommend this. I do think How to Marry a Millionaire is a fun movie. It's frothy.
It's a popcorn. Like, get some popcorn. Enjoy a little popcorn, fun little frolic.
And everybody's beautiful. The women are all beautiful. The costumes are great. If you are watching this, though, for Marilyn or Betty Grable, go in with tempered expectations because they are not the stars. And I wouldn't even say this is an ensemble piece. They're
really
good side players. What do you think, though, about this, Sarah? Do you recommend it?
Expectations are always important, right? And I think of it as a small little fun little romantic comedy. It doesn't have the scope of like a Gentleman's Preferred Blondes or a Niagara. It's not a big showcase for really anyone in the movie. You said it's really like a little ensemble piece with great costumes, and it's a fun little movie. But yeah, I think it's not epic in scope by any sense. It's just a small little fun little film.
Well, listeners, let me know your thoughts on How to Marry a Millionaire, Marilyn Monroe, Gene Nicolesco, The Robe, I don't care. You can email your thoughts to me at ticklishbiz@gmail.com, and I'll read them on the next episode. I'd once again like to thank Sarah Louise Lilly for joining me today. Sarah, where can fans find out more about the tour, find out more about you, get in touch with you, all of that?
Sure. Well, I'm on Twitter at Sarah L. Lilly. Information on the tour can be found on the TCM website or on locationtours.com. The website's that's the website for the tour as well. I'm easy to find. If you Google Sarah Louise Lilly, you will have more than enough information popping up.
That's going to close out this edition of Ticklish Business. As always, you can listen to Ticklish Business a multitude of different ways, either downloading directly at ticklishbusiness.podbean.com, via Stitcher Radio and Player FM, or on iTunes. If you are listening via iTunes, please consider leaving a rating and review. We are also on Spotify. As always, you can contact me directly at ticklishbiz, that's B-I-Z, at gmail.com, or visit me at my official website where I discuss classic films regularly, journeysinclassicfilm.com. The podcast is also on Twitter at ticklish_biz if you want to learn about what's upcoming, how late I am getting these episodes out, all of that. Want to learn more about upcoming shows or hear exclusive content before anyone else? Well, then consider supporting Ticklish Business via Patreon. I have a wealth of amazing perks, and all your donations go right back into making Ticklish Business the premier classic film podcast that it is. So if you want to know what actually is on Patreon, what you get for your dollar, if you become a patron right now, you can listen to the pilot episodes for my two new supplementary shows, co-host William Bibbiani and I look at how Hollywood talks about itself in cinema with the show Based on a True Podcast. Our first episode starts with the 1999 Orson Welles biopic RKO 281, and we just finished up our next episode looking at the George Reeves murder and the biopic Hollywoodland. I say murder, but is it? Yeah, that's the mystery. If you want to hear all of that, that is going to be up on the Patreon account soon. Also, you can hear Adam Kautzer and I talk about the 1958 and 1988 versions of The Blob on the other supplementary show I have, Doubled Features, a show looking at the features Hollywood films again and again. We're going to be prepping to record our next episode looking at all three, yes, three versions of The Bad Seed. So again, you can also be sure to check out my previous interviews with author Alan K. Rohde and Sarah Louise Lilly's first appearance on the show, her TCM. Interview that I did with her is also on there. So if you're interested in becoming a patron and want access to all the content that exists and is going to exist soon, as well as our new member newsletter that I'm doing along with Drea Clark and Samantha Ellis, giving you guys some TCM, film news, all sorts of stuff in your inbox, then you can head over to patreon.com/ticklishbiz. And if you want to learn more about the Stars Turning 100 this year, who I've been documenting in my centennial celebration episodes, if you're a member of TCM's exclusive fan club TCM Backlot, you can actually read my year-long series about the stars spotlighted on the show, and I talk about films and share information that you won't hear on the podcast. But next time, Drea Clark, one of our new Ticklish Business co-host, is going to be back as we honor centennial star Teresa Wright with a look at 1943's Shadow of a Doubt. Until next time.